You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That, where you hear coffee bubbling in the background for my next guest, whom I met, gosh, it's got to be like 16 years ago, backstage at a theater. He had a hot little young guy with him at the time, who I'm sure has gone by the wayside. Hey. Look, I saw the face.
I was like, myself a hot young guy.
You were indeed, but you were with another hot young guy. A show that he says that he is obsessed with, Caroline or Change, which is coming back to Broadway right now.
I am obsessed with that show.
And he is the national dance and theater editor for Time Out Magazine, and he is also the president of the New York Drama Critics Circle.
That is correct.
And so my guest is, did you guess already? Adam Feldman.
Ding, 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 ding. No one guessed. But that's okay.
So I don't think I remembered, I may have known because I'm sure we had this conversation when I met you, that you're from Canada.
I am. I'm from Montreal.
Je parle français?
Oui, je parle français. Not as well as once I did. It's funny because I grew up in the English-speaking minority of Montreal.
Okay.
So I was already sort of a minority within a minority within a minority.
And tell me what those minorities are.
Oh, well, okay. If you want to go even deeper in that, I grew up gay within the Jewish community, within the English-speaking community, within the French-speaking community, within the larger English community of North America.
Okay.
Know? So I do feel like that those concentric circles leading to my identity have given me, even though I think I present very much as a kind of regular cis white guy in his 40s, I think that I do have a little bit, a touch of knowledge about outsiderness, which is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am an immigrant. I'm not an immigrant from a disadvantaged country, but I do know what it's like to be in that position in some way.
And how do you get to stay in this country?
I had a series of visas, and now I have a resident. I have a green card.
Does that mean you're subject to the new denaturalization policy that the Justice Department just made?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I'm in the middle of applying now for my naturalization. For my whatever that's called, to become an American,
a naturalized
citizen.
Yeah. So you're going to learn all the things that real people who were born in America don't know. You're going to know more about America than people who were born here don't.
I always have. I was one of those kids. Like I knew all. I could name you all 100 senators when I was a teenager. You know, I was one of those kids, and so I'm not worried about the civics test part of it.
Okay,
I'm just worried a little bit about the timing because this government, as you know, is so capricious and so unstable. And you never know what strange, crazy laws they may throw out at any given moment.
No, that's real.
And so that does make me nervous. And it's one reason that that I'm going to be putting this application in now. I've been putting it off for a little bit. But I do want to try to stabilize that as much as I can.
And why do you want to become a citizen at this moment under this administration? I mean, to me, like, Americans are trying to go to Canada. Like, why are you trying to get an American citizenship?
I think I still have family in Canada. If it ever came to that, I think I would be able to go back to Canada.
So we don't make you give it up?
I'm not sure about that, but I don't think so. I don't think Canada makes me give it up, my citizenship. But even if they did, I have parents there. I have a sister and her family there. You know, I would be able to go back to Canada in some capacity. I feel confident.
Does Canada give you the UK?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. But I love living in New York. I love living in the United States, especially in New York. And New York, to some extent, as you know, is not really
the
America.
United States. It's not America. Yeah,
it's
not. Is not
it's a
America.
Different thing, you know. And it's a very international, cosmopolitan city. And so, for that matter, in its way, was Montreal. Montreal had the difference of being, first of all, much smaller, and second of all, mostly French. And so it was like a European cosmopolitan city.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of North America. But that was great to grow up in. I mean, I feel so lucky in retrospect. I go back and visit sometimes. I still have family there. And what a great city Montreal is. It's the funniest thing because we're so close to it here and nobody thinks about it because Americans, God bless us. You know, really, like the map stops outside the map of the United States. And I used to play this game with people. They would be like, where are you from? And I'd say, well, why don't you guess? And we would eventually land in the Northeast, and they would name every state. And they would be like they would be taking a test in their heads. They'd be like, do I remember all the
northeastern states?
Yeah. Yes. Like, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island. And they'd finally get, they'd go through all the states and then they would be baffled. They'd be like, I've named everywhere. And you just want to say, well, no, in fact, there's a whole second largest country in the world right on top of that. You know, I grew up an hour away from the Vermont border. I mean, I grew up, when I was growing up, Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont.
Oh.
So I've known Bernie Sanders, I mean, not personally, but like I've known of Bernie Sanders for a long time.
So you're saying that the politics of Vermont was leaning over into Montreal?
Well, we were, not the politics, but the television. Of Vermont, because we had Canadian television, but we
right.
also we had cable TV, and the American channels that would come in were from Vermont,
wow.
and from upstate New York, and so we would I would get all my news filtered through local Vermont television.
Okay,
Which was interesting, and Vermont is a lovely state and full of lovely people.
It's an unusual state in this country.
It's really strange,
though.
And it had a crazy switcheroo politically.
Yeah.
Because it's mostly rural.
Right.
And it's also, it used to be part of this kind of northeastern Republican bloc. It voted the most solidly Republican of any state until Bill Clinton. It had the most solidly Republican voting record. But that's because Republican meant something completely different. And all these southern states had the most solidly Democratic.
Forget that Lincoln was a Republican, and that's why right. blacks were traditionally Republicans.
Right, and that's why people in the South refused to vote Republican for 100 years after the Civil War. They were not forgiven it. And then when they couldn't vote for Democrats anymore because the Democrats were passing civil rights stuff, they made their own split-off party. They made the Dixiecrats. And you had Strom Thurmond running for
right.
president on a splinter Democratic Party, basically.
Right. You are quite educated about my country's politics.
I'm going to ace this civics test. But anyway, the thing, Montreal is really just this amazing gift and opportunity that is so close to people here, and people just don't think about it. It's only 45 minutes away on an airplane. The exchange rate is great. There's great food. There's great people. It's a really sexy town.
Montreal Tourism Board, right?
That's
here.
Right. I should be compensated for this.
And so, when are you moving back?
I'm not. I don't currently have any plans to move back. But I've lived in New York my entire adult life. I feel very much like a New Yorker.
When do you start that you were an adult?
I'm starting after college. So I should qualify that. But I think that college is sort of like a limbo zone between child and
adult. Caroline was like 16 years ago, and I thought you were kind of new.
I was kind of new. That was my first year at Time Out back then.
Okay, but you weren't new to America.
No, I'd been in America for a number of years at that point. I went to Harvard, and then I
Harvard.
Yes, the Harvard of the East.
And what'd you study there?
I ended up in English literature and language, but I had a journey to there because when I was in high school, I was very into politics, and I did a lot of debating. I was in the top five nationally debating in Canada. And that's what I thought I was going to do. I was going to be a lawyer, and then I was going to go into politics. And I went to Harvard in part because they had a really good government program, and I just assumed that is what I was going to do. And so my freshman year, I took all these government courses, and I realized I really didn't like government. And I didn't love the people who were in those courses.
It about them you didn't like? Because I felt this way about law students when I was in law school.
I don't know. They weren't my kind of people. I was drifting into a more artsy space, and I was doing theater on the side.
And at Harvard.
Clearly at Harvard, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have at that point a theater major there. They do now. But
ART around then?
It was. So it was right next door, and we used some of those spaces for student productions, and we had a sort of a teaching relationship a little bit with them. But it wasn't, and Robert Brustein was on the Harvard faculty, but it wasn't, there wasn't an academic framework for studying theater as a discipline or as a craft. So I found that I was really gravitating toward my electives in and I thought, well, maybe I can create my own kind of double major. So I went to the department heads and I said, I'd like to do a double concentration in government and English. And maybe we can find some way to do that. We can talk about like the language of constitutions or something like that, you know? We can find some way to bring these two things together. And the English department was super on board with it, and the government department was not budging. They were like, yeah, you can do a double concentration as long as you meet all the requirements for a full government concentration.
Oh.
And I was like, well, that's not going to happen.
So So what did you do?
So I moved my, this is, oh God, this is like the history of my academic career. I sophomore year, I changed concentrations into something called social studies, which is a combination, a more broad-based concentration that involved government, but also involved economics and history and sociology. And it was an all-honors concentration, and I didn't like that either. I mean, I did a lot of great reading. I got a lot out of it. I don't regret having done that. But again, I really felt like the only things I was really looking forward to were my electives that I was doing in English. And so I realized I got to fix this. And so my junior year, I switched into honors English, and I met all the, I spent the next 2 years meeting all of my requirements for English while doing theater on the side.
And what plays did you do?
Well, what plays was I in?
Well, I know you're a singer. I want to know about the musicals you did at Harvard.
I did The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Oh.
I played Jasper in The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which was great. It's the most fun one of the most fun times I've ever had on stage. I was in an original musical called A House Divided. By students who wrote it at the time. And I was in a Gilbert and Sullivan rarity called Utopia Limited that nobody ever does. And there's a reason for that. but it was great fun. And I was in The Hasty Pudding for 3 years, which was the most demanding. The Hasty Pudding was at that time an all-male theatrical group. It's one of the oldest in the country. It's like 172 years old this year. It's a student written and acted musical burlesque. And up until 2 years ago, it was an all-male cast. It was the last of that.
They let women in. Mm-hmm. They decided. Was there a lawsuit involved?
No lawsuit. But the times, it was a hard transition because it was the last. I mean, all of those troops, all of those colleges used to be all-male. And so these kind of burlesque-y musical comedies.
Men like into dress up like women because they do.
Yep, as they do, as they always have. And it was funny. It's a fabulous experience. And there were always women in the company, just not in the cast.
We ran all the backstage stuff.
Right. They were producing the show.
But we can't get those jobs in the real world.
Well, the feeling was that it was an artistic thing. You know, this is what the Hasty Pudding was. It was what had always defined the Hasty Pudding. And so it was very resistant to change. But it has now, and I think that's the right decision. And they're back. They're actually coming. We're recording this at a time when they are about to visit New York.
Hasty Pudding.
Yes, because every year. So the Pudding was a huge production. You'd run for like 3 or 4 weeks in Cambridge, like 6 times a week. And then you go on tour to New York and Bermuda. It took up our entire spring. I mean,
wow.
It's a huge musical comedy extravaganza with huge professionally done costumes and sets. It was like being in an off-Broadway show for months. And it was hard to juggle that with writing either academics. You know? But it was a tremendous experience.
Okay, so I've seen you perform, and you're really quite good. You have a wonderful voice.
Thank you.
So, you know, why did you then come to New York and not become a musical theater performer?
That is an interesting question. Well, I did do a musical after I graduated.
Professionally?
Yes, I did. I did an equity-eligible musical in Pennsylvania, in Haverford, Pennsylvania, that Scott Schwartz directed. And it was a musical about Alice in Wonderland, about Lewis Carroll. And I played half of it was set in modern England,
right.
and half of it was set in Wonderland. And I played the caterpillar. I had a crazy little patter song about mathematics or something. Anyway, it was a very good experience, but I moved to New York. I thought I was going to spend a year in New York. I wanted to take a year off of college, and I thought I was going to go and get my PhD.
In?
It depended, as it turned out. Well, anyway, either in English or in American studies.
To do what?
To become, I thought at the time, an academic.
Okay.
And I applied to the places I wanted to go, and I got into them. And then
where were they?
They were Columbia and Yale.
Okay.
And then I decided I didn't want to do it.
Why?
Oops.
Why didn't you want to do it?
I realized, I was really enjoying New York, and I was acting. I was doing off Broadway stuff. I was doing Shakespeare in the Parking Lot type stuff downtown, and I was enjoying that. I had a job that I was being paid fairly well for, so I was living pretty well for my age, and I enjoyed it. And I realized I didn't have the real drive to become a full-time academic. My interest wasn't sustainable.
But you also didn't even have the real drive to become a full-time actor.
Well, that's true. And that's a slightly different question.
But okay.
I love performing. I think that I hit a ceiling. If I'm honest with myself, I think I hit a ceiling in terms of how well I can be present as a character. You know, it's a different thing. I think that I think I top out as an actor.
I don't understand.
I do. I don't think I can inhabit another person.
Yeah, but people become stars for being personalities.
Well, no, that's true. And
okay,
maybe
so
I could
you could have been a personality.
I could have tried to be a personality star. But I don't know if I have enough personality for that, number one. Number two, this is where the immigration thing comes in. I didn't have the right to do it.
What do you mean? You didn't have the right to be in an equity play because
I didn't. No, I didn't have a visa for it.
Ah.
I had work-related visas. So I could work for free, but I couldn't... I couldn't really pursue, and I'm not saying this is what made the difference. There were a lot of different factors, but that was one of the things. You know, I would have had to go back to Canada, and if I had been serious about it, maybe I would have.
But what if you'd booked a Broadway show? They could have taken care of your visa problems,
maybe,
right?
But I wouldn't book a Broadway show. They wouldn't have booked me on a Broadway show. I have to build my way up to that, and so anyway,
this is your ideas.
This is my yeah. I could have gone to Toronto if I had been really serious about it. I would have returned to Canada. Toronto has a terrific theater scene.
It sure does.
And I would have gone there, and I would have pursued it there. I would have taken classes. I would have gotten better, and I could have pursued that.
You have a lot of standards for this.
I do. Well, you know, I'm a critic.
You became a critic. At this point, you're not a critic
no,
yet.
I'm not.
At this point in your life, you're just someone who's got a nice job. You're doing some theater on the side,
correct,
deciding you don't want to do the PhD as an academic. So, you know, I got my first Broadway show on my Christmas break from college at Carnegie Mellon.
Well, yeah.
So it could have happened for you.
Well, if I were Tonya Pinkins, then I could have done that.
You're Adam Feldman. I've seen you. You're very talented.
I am, but I'm not Tonya Pinkins. And there is a difference between those two things. And I feel, maybe I'm wrong, but I did feel like there was only so far I could go.
But do you feel that there was some pressure? I mean, like you were clearly a very heady academic. Was there internal pressure because, you know, actors are considered kind of the lowlifes of
the
world?
No, I mean, they are the lowlifes of the world. But,
but, you know, it's like Harvard to your parents. Were your parents going to be like, Harvard, you want to be an actor? What?
No. My parents would have been supportive. I did a lot of acting as a kid. They've always been wonderfully supportive that way. Ultimately, would prefer that I had gone to law school or something like that. At that time, at least, that's what they were hoping I would do because they wanted me to have a more stable fallback position than drifting around New York, being a dilettante at large. I actually had that printed up on business cards. But I think I don't regret that time. I had a really lovely entry into New York. It was a very exciting scene back there at that time. The Meatpacking District was still marginally the Meatpacking District mm-hmm. before the renovations, and so there were places like Jackie 60, this club that I used to go to every Tuesdays, where it was really just like a very exciting, queer, but unbelievably creative scene. And I met a lot of wonderful people, and I had a lot of wonderful experiences. I don't regret any of that.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
There was a time that when I began to regret it, when I'd been here for a few years, and uh, I didn't know what I was going to do next. I was still in the same job, and it was still paying fine, but it wasn't satisfying to me, and I began to think, geez, maybe I should go to law school. And then, sort of magically, I ended up becoming a critic.
How did that happen? How does that magically happen?
Well, in my case, I was participating on these online discussion groups about theater.
Like chat rooms?
Yeah, sort of. It was in the late 90s, and so it was on Unix. It was all text-based. You know, it was before the fancier versions of them that we have now. But it was a good group of people who were very passionate about theater, and I got into a lot of heated arguments with people, and I had strong opinions about things. And when Show Business Weekly was starting up again, which was sort of an alternative to Backstage, they wanted people to write for them, and someone reached out to me and said, hey, we like what you've been writing online. Would you like to review shows for us? And so I did, and I reviewed shows for them, and then I started doing it for Broadway.com back when they had reviews. And then a position opened up at Time Out, and they asked me to apply for it, and that was in 2003. So I've been there for 16 years.
Wow, that's like Carolina change.
It actually is exactly that, because Caroline was in November,
2003
December.
At the Public, yeah.
Yeah, at the Public, and that was the first show that I really loved as a critic at Time Out. And it was also one of the first, it was a very good experience, as you will remember. It was a good experience of disappointment. it was a good learning experience.
In what way?
Because, well, we can talk about Caroline, please, for okay. as much as you want. But Caroline, for me, is a very, very special show. It's really one of, if I had to assemble, and I hate making such lists for myself, but if I had to assemble like a list of the shows that had meant the most to me personally, had changed me most as a person, it is right up there in the top group. You know, it's in my top 5 or 10 shows of all time. It's a show, and we can talk about why, et cetera, later if you feel like it, but this is a show that I felt very, very passionately about and that I went to bat for as much as I could, but a show that did not get all of the critical support that it deserved in some other places. It was really sort of, there were a few of us, and I remember who it was because I felt so, I was really, I felt like it was Warren Camps at the time, people who were on the side of the Angels and people who weren't getting it. And so I remember it was me, it was John Halpern, it was John Lahr, and it was Lisa Gardner in USA Today, and Frank Rich wrote something nice about it, but he wasn't the critic at the time.
David Richards, I think, did as well.
Yeah, but that's it. And then everyone else was sort of mixed.
Well, you know, the politics behind that was Kushner and Brantley were having some, unknown to me, but we did know that they were having some personal testosterone match. And so even before we even went into production, we knew that Brantley was going to kill us and had already decided that the show was not even going to be considerable for a Pulitzer.
It's a strange thing. It's a strange thing how that happens. Because, you know, I'm not even saying, I can't speak for Ben Brantley. We haven't talked about this. But I think that in general, no one does this, I don't think, on purpose, but there are cycles that reputations ride out for critics. And this was about 10 years after Angels in America. And we were at that point in the cycle where people were asking, oh, is Tony Kushner really that great?
You know, they want to tear you down. They build you up.
They just feel like
they
praised him so much. And now is it time for a reevaluation? It's not that I don't think that anyone sits down and says that, but it's just that psychologically there's a feeling of that kind that sets in. And so people, and this was after Homebody Cobble, which people had received respectfully, but which was not Angels in America. And so we were at that point where it's like, oh, did we overpraise Tony Kushner as the next big thing? And I don't think they had. But nonetheless, there's that weird Oedipal thing. There was that. And also,
but I'm telling you that before the show existed, we knew we were going to get a bad review from the Times. So this is a predisposed thing that was discussed because contractually I got to sit in on all those marketing meetings.
That's fascinating. Well, I mean, also the show itself is initially challenging in some ways. And I think it's very telling that everywhere it went after New York, it got the reviews that it deserved.
Because, and it broke box office records and won the awards that it didn't win in America.
Right. But everyone else got it. And for a number of reasons. reasons. I mean, they'd had a chance to sit down with the cast album, get their heads around, get their ears around it. They had been able to read other people's opinions of it that put things in perspective for them, maybe that clicked the show in certain ways that they hadn't been able to connect before. It's hard when you're a critic, and I'm not blaming the people who didn't get it the first time. You're writing about it just a few days after you've seen it. It hasn't all settled in. And Caroline in particular poses certain challenges.
Like what?
Well, because it wasn't written to be a two-act show, for one thing. It doesn't have a clear two-act structure. So usually you'd have this crisis at the end of the first act, and you'd go out having the audience talking about it. And that crisis doesn't really happen until a third of the way through the second act. And so what it asks of you as an audience is to trust it. It says, this is set up, this is pulling back the bowstring, and go with it. Just, we're going somewhere, trust us, we're going somewhere interesting. And if you do, then you can go somewhere very personally meaningful, and I can attest to that personally. But if you give up on it, if you check out of it, then it's done. And I think people who didn't know yet, you know, when you're watching it for the first time, you don't have any guideposts. And this is where critics can be useful. If a critic helps set up that trust, a critic can tell you, this is really great, wait for it. You know?
Well, I remember reading it and going, oh, they're not doing Aristotelian story structure here. Mm. And I was like, okay, but these are brilliant people. It's going to be cool. And I feel in a certain sense, Wild Party was the beginning of laying the path for these shows that don't follow that traditional three-act structure. People just still weren't quite ready for it. And as George used to say, if you came in to see Caroline and you were like, I am not going to feel anything, mm-hmm. then you had to hate it the whole way.
Right.
Because you couldn't feel one thing and it was going to take you on a journey you were going to feel.
Right. And yeah. It also has this strange device of her talking to the appliances and the moon. And it has this very Morris Sendak quality, you know. And if you enter into that imaginative space, then it's very welcoming. And if you tune out and you say, what is this? Why is she talking to a dryer? then you're going to be like, oh, over it. And that is the wrong attitude towards this particular play, because the play goes deep and dark places.
And you have to be willing to want to inhabit a person who is not usually valued in
yes.
this world, which is a maid.
This is what I love. This is one of the things that I love about it. And I don't want to sound naive about it when I talk about it, or I don't, I guess I will. I was a younger person. And this may speak to that, but this is a character, the type of which we almost never see in a musical. Most musicals are about a self-actualizing person.
Mm-hmm.
And the world says no, and she says yes, and then the world ends up stepping aside.
Yes.
And there are a few, and Gypsy is not one of those, and that's one of the reasons that Gypsy is one of the great musicals. This is another one of those. This is a person you never see on stage, or you see them in peripheral roles. And it's not just because she's a maid, it's because she's mean and unhappy, and she does not change. She is not able to actualize herself and
exactly.
her dreams, you know? Like,
yes.
it's the opposite of what a musical usually
yes.
does. So it asks you, but this is the thing. This is why it was so special to me, because I feel like in real life, I meet those people all the time.
Yes. We're all that person.
Yeah, and I'm that
person. At some point
yeah.
in our life.
I'm that person, and everyone is that person, but especially people who are in service positions or things, you know, like you'll be at the MTA, you'll be at the booth and you'll be like, why can't you just make my change faster? Why can't you just smile? I'm smiling. Can't you be nice? And it's not like you're wrong. Like they are being mean and so, but also what right do you have to demand that they be happy doing a job that they probably don't love?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it really, for me, and I know this sounds naive, you know, like I should have known this all along, and I did on some level intellectually know this all along, but on a deep personal level, I feel like this show has helped me be a better person on a daily basis. It's helped me stop myself from judging other people. It's helped me remind myself that other people have lives and that other people who are behaving in certain ways may be doing it for reasons that I have no comprehension of. And just to step back and be generous to people, you know, and allow them to be unhappy if that's what where they are.
Yeah.
And don't demand that they pretend to be.
Yeah. I mean, that was the gift of the show for me is most things that I ever did, people were always asking me to be likable. Can you be likable? And that is something George Wolfe never asked of me. And I think that George Wolfe may be the only director who would have done that. And I think because of my willingness to go to that deeply vulnerable, ugly place, everybody recognized themselves in that place. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has been that at some point in time. And to me, that's the cathartic part of that show, is that.
It is. And that's where it's a deeply humane, transformative show. For me, and I hope that anyone who sees it can go into it with that opportunity to experience that.
I've been watching the ads for the new version that's happening, and I look at it and I'm like, oh no, I think they've turned her into a happy maid.
I hope that's not true.
I hope it's not true too. But the ads definitely have the stars and the sun around.
The ads are
her.
Selling it.
The ads are selling the happy maid. Well, so it'll be interesting to see.
Or maybe it'll surprise people. The other thing about that show, I'm sorry, I talk about this show so much. For people who have listened to me on podcasts before, they will already have heard me talk about Caroline so much. And I apologize to all of my three fans who listen to my podcasts. But I mean, this is stuff that, because I'm obsessed with this show. I have been for 16 years. And I mean, I saw it five and a half times. I second acted it once on Broadway. I mean, the other thing with this show is that because Tony is a prophet, I don't mean that in a supernatural way. I just mean he's unusually attuned to vibrations in the culture that mm-hmm. other people have not picked up yet because he is so enormously intelligent and mm-hmm. sensitive. And so this show is about economic disparity. This mm-hmm. show is about white privilege. This show is about taking down Confederate statues. Mm-hmm. This show is about stuff that was not going to be in the public discourse in a big way for another 10 years.
Yes.
And people were not ready for it in 2003. Yeah. And now
they're ready for it. Yes, absolutely. And it's about the next generation.
Yes.
You know, Caroline is not the protagonist of that show. And there was a version of Lot's wife that existed before we did it at the public that they cut because they said, if you did that version, the show had to end. Mm-hmm. And Tony was committed to the epilogue, which is Emmy.
Well, and I've said this before, but that's what's special. That's something that's very important to me about the show, because let's imagine that Emmy goes on and becomes a civil rights leader.
Mm-hmm.
Of some kind, right? And articles are written about her. They will say, you know, she's the daughter of a maid. Like they say, like, the son of a sharecropper. You know? And the implication is that they come from nothing.
Right.
But what is that nothing? Who is that nothing? Who has made themselves nothing in order for that narrative, that later narrative, to be possible?
Yes.
So this show is about that person, and you never see that person.
Right.
So, I mean, Emmy is there, and it's...
And she's the better version of her mother.
And it's hopeful, but she's the better version of her mother. She's the version that her mother makes possible.
Right. Because her mother does not destroy that spirit in her.
No, but she destroys her own spirit.
Right.
And the killer line for me is, take her away because I can't afford her.
Mm.
You know, she, take Caroline away. Mm-hmm. Like Caroline sings this mm-hmm. about herself. Mm-hmm. Caroline, it's an act of self-suicide. But mm-hmm. she can't literally kill
right.
herself because she has responsibilities.
Right. And there's so many people in our world that is their reality every day.
So many people. And her dreams of hooking up with Nat King Cole or anyone else are never going to happen.
Are never going to happen.
And this Lot's wife, which is why it's so brutal and so beautiful and so moving, is her acceptance of her lack
her
of
lot
the future.
In life.
Her lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a pillar of salt. She is the one who can't go on. She's the one who's stuck back
yeah.
in Sodom and Gomorrah. She can't move on with the next people.
Right.
She can't stop looking back.
Right.
And that's, I think, anyone, I mean, some people have it much harder than other people.
That
but
is true.
But everyone can understand it on some level.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. I'm very down on Aristotelian story structure. I think it's a tool of the ruling class to give, you know, us plebes a little joy. Like, oh, we have a hero's journey and we can survive. But really, most people are not the heroes of their life. And most people are not taking actions that turn their life in another way. Most people are like dodging life and surviving the life that gets thrust upon you is the heroic act mm-hmm. for those who live through their lives. thoughts, Mr. English major from Harvard?
I think that there are different ways that you can experience these stories, and different myths serve different purposes. I mean, I don't think all of myths are heroic myths. A lot of them are. If you look at the actual myths, I mean, I just saw Medea again, a modernized version of Medea. Nobody goes out of Medea saying, yeah, I should kill my kid. I hope you don't. But Medea is, you know, those tragedies, most of them are not, they're tragedies.
They
don't end well. A lot of them are life lessons. And there's if you follow that particular myth a little longer after what happens with Jason, he ends very badly. He in some versions of it, he becomes a drunk and he's wandering the earth and he finds a ruin of the Argo, his old ship, and he's killed by a falling branch of the rotting Argo. So it's a very dark,
I like a tragedy. Like a tragedy.
It's very dark. So it's not. But I do think that the hero's journey things have their role too. You know, not that everyone can make their lives that way, but everyone likes to think that they could, maybe in some small way at least.
And it's definitely feel good. I'm not against feel good stories.
And it can inspire people to make changes in their lives.
Absolutely.
And so I'm, you know, I'm for that, but I don't want everything to be that.
This is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to You Can't Say That. My guest today is Adam Feldman, and we deconstruct Carolina change, politics, and the Constitution. That was part one. Come back for part two.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.